This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Today on Basic, Weird Al Yankovic.
Before Eat It, I mean, a few people knew who I was, but I was very much a cult figure. You might have known me from the Dr. Demento show. My first two videos didn't get a ton of airplay on MTV. But Eat It, man, I mean, you talk about overnight fame. I remember having to, I think I recorded Beat It off of MTV on a VHS tape and then took Polaroids off the TV screen for reference, which we had on set. So very old school, yeah, but that's how we did it, and we try to match it as closely as possible. Again, you know, obviously, very quick shoot. We recreated it as closely as we could, and man, that was the best $40,000 I ever spent in my life. That video just changed my life.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Basic, the official podcast of the unofficial history of cable television. I'm Doug Herzog, a former TV executive, and I love Rocky Road.
And I'm Jen Chaney, a TV critic for Vulture and New York Magazine. And I've churned butter once or twice, living in an Amish paradise.
Our guest today is maybe not what you would call a true cable TV star, but it was the advent of cable and in particular MTV and music videos that really propelled him to the forefront of popular culture.
That is absolutely right. Weird Al Yankovic is a true original and an American treasure. While his song parodies first brought him fame and fortune, he's also an accomplished musician, a comic writer, a director, and he still tours to packed houses of all ages around the globe. And he also recently wrote and produced his delightful, funny, and clever biopic parody, Weird, the Al Yankovic Story for Roku, which Doug and I are both very big fans of.
And you can still see it there on Roku, so check it out. His enduring popularity, especially among our staff here at Basic, makes him one of the most anticipated guests we've ever had. So sit back and enjoy our conversation with the one and only Weird Al.
And don't forget to keep listening to the end when Doug and I will discuss all the weirdness and possibly become parodies of ourselves. Well, Weird Al Yankovic, we are so honored to welcome you to this episode of Basic. We're thrilled that you're here.
Me too.
And we want to start by asking you the same question that we ask of all of our guests, which is, do you remember when you first got or saw Basic Cable?
Oh, gosh. It would have been sometime after MTV debuted. That was 81. And I'm going to say maybe circa 1982, maybe 83. And I was living in a $300 a month apartment in Hollywood with a Murphy bed that folded out from the wall. But my one luxury was I got cable TV because I really wanted to have MTV and watch it 24 hours a day. And I remember shortly after I got cable, MTV started their whole, you know, watch us in stereo promotion, like, you know, what? You know, MTV in stereo. And it was such an alien concept to me to watch television and stereo, but I hooked up my TV speakers to the television, and it changed my life. My world changed on that day.
Do you remember any of the videos you saw at first?
Oh gosh, I mean, whatever was popular in the 1982, 83, like Men Without Hats, and MTV was playing a lot of Devo back then, mm-hmm. And just, it was the very early days of MTV, so not everybody was making music videos. It wasn't until like MTV like really caught on that it was like required to have a music video for your single,
right?
Yeah, that was the secret to MTV in the old days. You know, for the bands anyway, they didn't have a lot of videos, and the ones that did get played were, you know, got real big real quick.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was like, you know, Rod Stewart and Devo were making videos for like the Midnight Special in the 70s. So they had this backlog of videos. So they were in like hot rotation back in the early days.
Hence REO Speedwagon.
Yes.
So Al, you had another life-changing event much earlier in your life. And of course, by the way, we all saw the movie and we love
Thank
the movie.
You.
It's on Roku, folks. We'll get to that later. But and this is a big part of at least the early part of the movie is, you know, you started playing the accordion at a very young age. So what was it about the accordion, which is not like, you know, the first thing you think about probably when you're a young kid? Most kids, I think about drums or guitar. What was it about the accordion that so entranced you?
Well, I have to say, full disclosure, I'm pretty sure I was not begging my parents for accordion lessons. but when I was like 6 years old, my parents made the decision that I should take the lessons. And it is the story in the movie. We took some liberties with it, but there are some true nuggets in there. And one is that a guy actually came around to our house, like a door-to-door salesman, offering music lessons. And the two instruments he was offering were accordion lessons and guitar lessons. And my parents had the foresight to realize that accordion music was going to take over Western civilization. So they made the prescient decision to give me accordion lessons, which, you know, they figured they wanted me to be really popular in high school and the life of every party. So, yeah, they made that decision on my behalf.
Well, you know, small cable TV fun fact was, you know, one of the first things HBO ever televised, I believe, was a polka concert from Pennsylvania.
Is that true?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So wow. Maybe your parents knew something.
Maybe you saw that, Al. Who knows?
I didn't have HBO back then.
Nobody did, I don't think, actually. But
I'm just curious, though, because I've never attempted to play the accordion, but it seems to me like it would be a hard instrument to learn. Did you find it to be?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I learned, like I said, when I was very, very young. And when you're young, the synapses in your brain are connecting more rapidly. And it's easier to learn anything, languages, music, anything. It's a good age to learn things. But I figured that accordion was a hard instrument to learn when I tried to teach Daniel Radcliffe how to play the accordion. Yeah, I gave him some private lessons. And he did very well. He was very committed. He didn't want to look like he was faking it. But, you know, it reminded me that, yeah, it's kind of a difficult instrument because the right hand you're playing like a piano keyboard and the left hand you're playing a series of buttons, and then you have to also remember to push the bellows in and out, and you may or may not be singing at the same time. So it's like a little, you know, patting your head and rubbing your belly kind of thing.
Right. And it's heavy, right? A little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly play with a child size, or the sexist term, lady size accordion on stage, because, you know, it is, some of them, you know, are like you're carrying a house on your chest.
Right.
But, you know, and I run around stage and jump around a lot, so I tend to wear a smaller sized accordion. But yeah, it does wear on you after a while.
So the Dr. Demento, the legendary Dr. Demento radio show, was a huge influence on you. He gave you your first break, a little bit of a mentor, I think, as well. So a two-pronged question here. Could you just remind our listeners who may not be old enough to remember, like, what Dr. Demento, who he was and what he was all about, and what made you decide to submit your very first song to him?
Dr. Demento is an icon in radio. He was on the air starting in the early 70s. He's not on terrestrial radio anymore, but he's still doing a show every week online, drdemento.com. He started out just playing regular songs on I think it was KPPC in Los Angeles. And he noticed that whenever he played a novelty song or something that was funny, the phones lit up. And so he sort of gravitated toward that, and he got dubbed Dr. Demento because the music he played was demented. And it changed into a four-hour show live on KMET every week. And that's where I first heard of him and got obsessed with him. His show became nationally syndicated, and he was, you know, on the radio and beloved for several decades. But he's got an extensive collection of not only comedy records, but, like, I think he's got a master's degree in blues music. He's quite, you know, learned in all things musical. He knows a lot about everything, but he's famous for being Dr. Demento. And if it hadn't been for him, I would have a very different life right now.
I mean, the idea to compose kind of funny songs in the way that you do, I assume that kind of was sparked by listening to that show.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's where I first heard people like Spike Jones and Stan Freberg and Tom Lehrer and Alan Sherman. And I kind of was finding my people, you know, but all those artists weren't contemporary. I mean, you know, Spike Jones was from the 40s and 50s and early 60s. I mean, these are people that were basically before my time. But I still thought, you know, all right, well, I'm going to send them my own songs. On the urging of some friends, I recorded some songs on a little 39-cent compact cassette in my bedroom, just me and my accordion. And you know, horrible recordings and terrible songs. But Dr. Menno, again, my parents were smart. Dr. Menno said that he wouldn't have played those songs if I was playing the guitar. But the accordion made me stand out there. Here's a teenage kid playing the accordion and thinking he's cool. So I've got to give this kid like a leg up.
So you get all through school, you get a little notoriety around the Dr. Demento thing, but you head off to college. Was life in music something you were still thinking about at that point, or?
Well, just as a hobby. I mean, I never in my wildest dreams thought I'd have a career in showbiz. I don't come from a show business family. I grew up around
LA.
Not a
Nepo baby?
No, Nepo baby. I just thought, you know, considering that the accordion is my main axe and I do what's considered novelty music, it doesn't seem like I would have like a 40-year-long recording career. It just, nobody was anticipating that. Certainly not me. And nobody wanted to sign me in the early 80s because they thought, oh, you know, this is funny, but, you know, we want to sign artists that are going to have a lengthy career. We want to build an artist's career. And, you know, novelty music is basically the domain of one-hit wonders. So nobody was interested.
Mm-hmm. But at college was kind of transformational for you because I believe that's where you first performed in front of, you know, a live audience of your peers. And you also started writing, you know, songs that became popular when you were still in college, which I think is so incredible. I think there's even a plaque next to the bathroom where you recorded another one from Brides
of Bus. My Bologna, yeah.
Or My Bologna, sorry. Yeah.
My Bologna, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, that's sort of like where I first dipped my toe into live performance. There was like they called it a coffee house. It was basically a little weekly show in the student union at Cal Poly. And mostly it was like guys getting up with their acoustic guitar and playing Dan Fogelberg covers. And it was just kind of a mellow acoustic night. And I would get up on stage with my accordion. My friend Joe would play the bongos and we'd play these ridiculous songs and people's jaws would just drop. And I loved getting that reaction. And you know, I thought, well, this is more fun than getting an architecture degree. Like, what am I doing? I should be doing this.
So you had, of course, My Bologna, and then you followed up with another one, Rides the Bus.
Uh-huh.
This is all while you're still in college, right?
Yeah. My Bologna was recorded in the men's bathroom. Again, that's one of the partly true things from the movie. Yeah, that was, in fact, recorded in a public restroom because I couldn't afford a real recording studio, and the bathroom had a nice warm reverb sound. And another one, Rides the Bus, was actually recorded live on the Dr. Demento show, but while I was still in college. And, you know, this is before the internet. I didn't have a record deal, certainly, at this time. It was just something I did for fun. But
so who was putting out those records, Al?
Well, it wasn't a record when it first came out. It was just Dr. Demento playing.
It's just something Dr. Demento would play.
Yeah, he just hit record on his real
exclusive
recorder. Yeah. It was basically an air check of the live performance. We just got together one night and just played it, and he happened to record it, thankfully, because that air check is still to this day the master recording of the song.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was weird for me because it was right before my last quarter in college, and I went back to Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, and I'd go to class and I'd come back and my roommate would say, some New Zealand radio station wants to know how they can get a hold of another one, Rides the Bus. Like, everybody around the world was like trying to track me down to figure out how to get a copy of the song.
Wow.
Including, I guess, Scotti Brother Records, right, at the time?
Well, that was a little before Scotti Brothers. Another one, Rides the Bus, actually came out on TK Records as a single.
Oh, sure. From Florida. Yeah, yeah, the great dance
KC
label.
And the Sunshine Band.
KC and the Sunshine Band.
And
yeah.
I had the distinction of, I think, being the last thing they put out before they went bankrupt, which was about a week after the single came out.
Harry Stone.
Yeah.
Oh, the great Harry Stone. So, but then you get a major label deal.
Yeah. Yeah, so 1982, I signed with Scotti Brothers. It was a 10-album deal, which, you know, I don't think anybody anticipated that I would actually have 10 albums. But it was one of those draconian kind of things where I was like, I was literally working for a minimum wage in a mailroom. And it was like one of those kind of things where, like, if by some fluke you happen to be successful, we've got you for 10 albums. It was that kind of a deal. And nobody thought that would happen.
but that's actually kind of incredible. incredible, though, given what you were doing at the time, which was, for lack of a better term, you know, these, you know, a couple of one-offs that were sort of, I guess, seen as, quote, novelty songs. But that this record company, not only did they want you, they wanted you for a long time and I guess maybe saw a little bit of the future.
Maybe. I mean, I think they're kind of covering their bases. It's one of those kind of things where in the contract is like, and this contract is available on the planet Jupiter. You know, it's like it's some all-encompassing kind of thing where like, we've got you. And in fact, that contract, after I became, got actually popular, that contract got renegotiated twice because it was a horrible deal. And each time it got renegotiated, they tacked on two more albums. So it became a 14-album deal, which I finally completed with my last album in 2014. So after 32 short years, I finally fulfilled my recording contract.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
I'm very curious to hear from you about your songwriting process because, you know, I've read a little bit about it and it sounds very painstaking and very carefully researched. And I think a lot of people, you know, they hear some of your songs or anything that sounds effortless. It got that way because somebody put a lot of effort into making it sound like it's exactly the way it should have been. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because it sounds like pretty intense.
Yeah, there's a lot more work that goes into it than you might think. You know, you think, oh, silly, you know, novelty song. But I'll spend weeks and sometimes months on songs just to fine tune it and make sure it's as good as it can be. I collect ideas and themes and jokes. And then just once I have dozens of pages of notes, I condense that into song form. It's like a puzzle, especially when you're doing the parodies, because you know exactly how many lines you have, how many syllables per line, what the meter is on each line. So it's a puzzle that I like to do. And, you know, when I did like Another One Rides the Bus, I probably wrote that in like 20 minutes because it was just as a goof for the Dr. Demento show. I didn't think it was like something I'd be playing on stage to this day. So, but after I realized that people actually cared about what I did and that I'd have to live with these songs for a long time, then I started putting more and more time into it. And every album I got a little bit more obsessive compulsive about my songwriting.
And how does the process go with the artist, right? I'm assuming back in those days, although I there was a connection between you and the Knack, right? I think I read that. But I mean, do you have to say go to Nirvana and say, I've got this idea for one of your songs? Or how does that work?
Well, the term I use in every single interview where this question comes up is gray area, because legally it is. for the Knack and Queen, that was before I had a record deal. That was before I knew anything about the business. I mean, when I did Another One Rides the Bus, I just did it. We just did it on the air. And then we heard from Queen's people saying, you probably should have asked us about this, but it's cool. But next time, maybe just ask. And Doug Feiger from the Knack was actually somewhat responsible for my Bologna winding up on Capitol Records, because I went to see the Knack in concert at my college and got backstage and talked to Doug Feiger. And he goes, oh, you're the My Bologna guy. And he turns to the guy to his immediate right, who was Rupert Perry, vice president of Capitol Records who just happened to be there. And Doug said, oh, you should put this guy's record out. And Rupert went, oh, okay. but nowadays, yeah, it's it, like I said, it's a gray area. I could get away with it. It's viewed as fair use in most cases, but I never want to do, you know, get away with just what's legal. I respect artists and songwriters, and I always want to make sure that they're in on the joke, that they're not offended. And if they don't want me to do a parody, I will walk away.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you got, you know, the level of buy-in you needed, like you said, from the Knack, and I believe Michael Jackson was a fan of what you were doing. Were there artists that you really wanted to, you know, do parody songs of that didn't quite work out to your advantage? Like, what about Prince? Did you ever try to do a Prince song?
Yeah. I was going to say, famously, the one that got away was Prince, because I had about a half a dozen different ideas for Prince songs over the years. And I didn't give up. Every time I had an idea that I liked, we would, you know, my manager would talk to his reps and try to get word to him. And he never gave a reason why, but he always said no. He was just a little precious about, you know, he didn't want people making fun of his music or doing parodies or anything like that. I think he had a pretty good sense of humor. He just, but not about his own music so much.
Sure.
And despite the fact you got this great big record deal, which sounds, I mean, you know, I know it was draconian in a certain sense, but it was also 10 albums, which, you know, took you a long time to get to. Did they let you do your thing? Did they try and shape you as record companies do? I mean, because you do a very singular, individual, very specific thing, including writing original music, right? And also including doing polka versions of, you know, different popular songs as well as and comedy. And so what was that relationship like early on?
At the very beginning, they kind of let me do whatever I wanted because they just figured it was like, you know, nothing's going to happen with this. It's just like a fluke. It's a one-off. This guy's probably not going to be around next year. Go ahead and do whatever you want. And then after Eat It came out and it was like an international hit, then they started thinking, oh, we should tell Al what to do. So there's a brief window of time where they're giving me notes. And I remember for my third album, I had Like a Surgeon in the can. And I thought, okay, this is going to be the next single. And the record company said, yeah, you really need to have a Cyndi Lauper parody on this album. And I said, well, I don't have any great ideas for it. And they said, well, I don't think we really want to put out this album unless you have a Cyndi Lauper parody on it. So they really twisted my arm, and I came up with Girls Just Want to Have Lunch, which isn't my proudest moment. In fact, I think you can kind of even hear the resentment in my performance, like, girls just want to have lunch. I'm doing this against my own will. I'm under duress doing this song.
That actually makes it funnier, to be honest. Please correct me if any of this sounds wrong, but I believe the first two videos you did were for Hey Ricky and I Love Rocky Road.
That's right.
Then you did the video for Eat It, which is a shot-for-shot remake of Beat It, and pretty ambitious thing to attempt. Can you talk about the process of doing that? Did it feel like a bigger deal to you?
Yeah, it was big. I mean, my manager hates when I talk about money, but the first video was, the budget was $3,000, and the second video was $9,000, and Eat It we did for $40,000. It was a huge budget. And so I'm backtracking a little bit. I remember when we did our first video for $3,000, Scotty Brothers' note was like, that was good. Can we have you do 10 more videos for $30,000? And I said, no. but yeah, so we did the Eat It video. And I remember, gosh, this is before the internet. I remember having to, I think I recorded Eat It or Beat It off of MTV on a VHS tape and then took Polaroids off the TV screen for reference, which we had
on
set. So
that is pre-internet.
Old school, yeah. But that's how we did it. And we try to match it as closely as possible. Again, you know, obviously, very quick shoot.
Right.
We got Vince Patterson, who was the original choreographer and gang leader in the Michael Jackson video. So he was in mine. And we didn't get the same exact sets that Michael had because those were torn down or didn't exist in somehow. But we recreated it as closely as we could. And man, that was the best $40,000 I ever spent in my life. That video just changed my life.
It's a great video.
Yeah, I remember seeing it when I was younger. I was blown away by it, but it changed because it raised your profile to an even greater degree.
Well, exponentially, yeah. I mean, before Eat It, I mean, a few people knew who I was, but I was very much a cult figure. You might have known me from the Dr. Demento show. My first two videos didn't get a ton of airplay on MTV. But Eat It, man, I mean, you talk about overnight fame, and it kind of was literal.
It was also the height of the Michael Jackson thing, right?
The height of the Michael Jackson thing.
And everybody was just desperate for anything related to Michael Jackson, and you showed up with the funniest thing ever.
Thank you. Yeah, he was the most famous person in the universe, and MTV was just really kind of peaking there in its golden years. And, the period of time when people would just have MTV on all the time, like video wallpaper, it was just on. And if you had a video in heavy rotation, that meant that you were exposed to it, 7 or 8 times a day. That's one of the reasons we were able to make fun of the Beat It video like that, because people were intimately familiar with the Michael Jackson video. So we could recreate it shot for shot and just tweak a few things here and there and make it funny. It was, literally the day after it went into heavy rotation, people were stopping me on the street. People were staring at me. People were, picking me out of line at the fast food restaurant saying, "Aren't you the Eat It guy?" So it was very,
it was a globally shared reference of music and visuals, right?
Yeah.
Everybody knew what you were doing, right? They're like, they knew that video.
Yeah, I mean, it was very odd for me because I did a promotional tour of Japan, and it was odd for me to be literally on the other side of the world. I remember I was in some kind of skyscraper in Tokyo. There was a music box there, and it was mostly Japanese title, but also Eat It by Weird Al Yankovic. I was like, wow, this is crazy. This is crazy.
That's hilarious.
So that all led to the creation of something you did on and off for many, many, many years with MTV, which was Al TV.
Yeah.
What do you remember about how that all got started?
That was fun. I think that we did the first one as an April Fool's Day prank. It was a 4-hour show.
Right.
And they had very little budget, but they basically let me do whatever I wanted. It was, these are the early days of MTV where it's very guerrilla. It felt like public access. It had that kind of vibe to it where like things would go wrong and the DJs would make mistakes and the cameras wouldn't turn on at the right. And it just felt like your local, like you're watching a UHF channel. But I love that about it. It was just very, very homegrown. And this was during a time when literally they said, "Yeah, you got 4 hours of programming, have fun." And I did.
So you said doing, the early days of Al TV was like, cable access or UHF. And that's a good segue to your superstardom led to a feature film called UHF, now considered, I believe, a cult classic. Two things. Could you remind our audience, who might be too young to remember, what UHF television was? And then talk a little bit about the film and how that all came about.
Yes, it's kind of an anachronism. I wish I would have come up with a different name for that movie. Even in the late 80s, it was like kind of going out of style. But growing up, UHF channels were the ones past the first 13, which are the VHF channels. So 2 through 13 were, broadcast. And then if you went to the UHF dial, when it was an actual dial.
Separate dial.
You could good. And these channels were more independent, some kind of public access.
Spanish language, a lot of Spanish language channels.
Yeah. And just weird stuff. Like if you wanted to see the weirdest programming on TV, it was going to be on a UHF channel because it was like people broadcasting in other closets. It was just like really homegrown stuff. And I thought, and that was sort of like the basis of the movie, like this low budget indie TV channel that competes with the networks.
And it was also like, a bunch of outsiders, right? Like that, which was part of, I think, sort of the appeal of what you were doing in general was, you're doing your own thing and having fun with the world from your perspective and not necessarily going down the same road everybody else did.
Yeah, that's sort of one of the ironies of my career is as I started out as this outsider kind of making fun at all the people, on the inside of the bubble, like the pop music elite, all these celebrities. And it was fun to do that. But then I started finding myself at the same award shows, on the same parties, as these people, I'm rubbing elbows with the people I'm making fun of. So I was like, that was a slightly different dynamic.
That is the life. Well, you're you are a comedian as well as a musician. I think that goes with the territory sometimes.
Yeah.
Right. So one more thing on UHF. We did a big promotion for it at MTV. We had something called Camp MTV,
yes,
which we shot at my beloved summer camp in Elizaville, New York. where I dragged you and your cast, which included Michael Richards, pre-Seinfeld, I believe, Victoria Jackson from SNL, and yourself. I don't remember if Fran was part of that at all.
I don't think
but
so.
But did you remember anything about that particular day and being up at summer camp?
It's a fuzzy memory. Every now and then I try to track down videos on YouTube. I think was Colin Quinn there? I think he might have been there.
Colin, I mean, everybody. I mean, it was like Ed and Dre and Colin Quinn.
Yeah.
Kenny Ober and Randy of the Redwoods.
Oh, yeah.
And I think we had a rock band perform at the end of it. And I can't remember who.
No, it was a blast. I mean, that was a long time ago, and my memories are a little hazy, but I had the best time at Camp MTV.
there are small snatches of it on YouTube and on eBay. Every once in a while, you can find a Camp MTV T-shirt.
Ooh,
turns up.
I still have mine.
Do you really?
My wife let me keep it. Yeah, that was in the keeper pile.
Do you still have one, Doug?
That's a collector's item. I don't. I wish I do.
I would like one.
But I wouldn't give her one of those. Yeah.
Well, you just alluded to this a few minutes ago, Al, that, you know, you are technically an outsider, but you kind of became an insider. And, you know, over the years, I think your reputation as a legitimately talented musician has only grown and grown to the point where a lot of, you know, people in the rock world really have great respect for you.
And the comedy world.
And the comedy world, both. Yeah, absolutely. How does it feel to be sort of on the inside after coming from it from the outside?
It's a little odd, you know. It's, you know, when I first started out, it was hard to get our phone calls returned. You know, my manager would call up artists and say, "Hi, I represent Weird Al Yankovic." And they'd say, "Oh, I'm sorry." but after Michael Jackson kind of turned the key, after we got Michael Jackson's permission and blessing, that was good ammunition, because then we could go back to people and say, "Well, you know, Michael Jackson didn't seem to have a problem with it." And, you know, so that helped out a lot. But yeah, in fact, nowadays, I've been doing it for so long that it's sort of a rite of passage. It's sort of like artists know that they've made it. They're going for their We Got, which is an EGOT plus a Weird Al parody. They gotta get the whole thing.
It's kind of like getting your own Comedy Central roast or something.
Right.
As you got bigger, did there become a point where artists would approach you and say, "Hey, have you ever thought about doing one of my songs?"
Yeah, I'm not going to mention any names, but every now and then I'm going to.
I don't want to embarrass anybody.
Every now and then, somebody will, you know, come up to me at a party or whatever and say, "When are you going to do one of my songs?" And I'll draw up one name because it still blows my mind. This in 1984, shortly after I, you know, kind of came into the public consciousness with Eat It, I was at a party and I ran into Paul McCartney, and I'm, you know, he's one of my favorite people in the world. I'm a huge Beatles fan. And he said, "Oh, when are you going to do one of my songs?" And my head kind of exploded. And I don't know what I said. I probably stammered and passed out. But it was an amazing experience.
And how come you haven't? How have you? And I forgot.
Well, I tried to do a parody of Live and Let Die called Chicken Pot Pie, but Paul didn't like that.
He didn't love that one?
He's vegetarian, so it didn't scan with him.
Right.
And how about these days, Al, like choosing songs? You know, Michael Jackson, you know, and 1984, when all this started, you know, for you, or all came together for you. I mean, he was the biggest artist in the world, and everybody acknowledged it. He crossed over every format. He was on every radio station. He was all over MTV. I mean, it's what everybody listened to. Now, cut to 2023, and the music industry's changed dramatically, right? It's much more fragmented and much more segmented. So how do you identify the songs that you think will connect in this environment?
You know, I've been kind of taking a break from actual parody songs for a little bit, and partly is just because I wanted to take a break, and partly is because of that which you mentioned, is we don't have that monoculture anymore. Back in the 80s, you know, everybody watched MTV, everybody knew what the hit songs were, and certainly there are superstars now, and there are hit songs now, but kind of not in the way that it was a couple decades ago, because it used to be that, you know, our culture wasn't quite so fragmented and everybody was into their, you know, whatever subculture or subgenre they were into. Everybody was sort of like tuned into the same thing. So it made it a little bit easier to tweak, you know, the big pop songs of the day.
I also feel like fandoms have become intense in a different way now around really big people. Like, for example, if you tried to do a parody of a Taylor Swift song, I think the Swifties would come for you, even if it's in good spirit, you know?
That's always the case. I mean, you know, that happened with the Nirvana. Like, there were a lot of Nirvana fans at the time that were up in arms.
We're way too cool for Weird Al.
No one's too cool for Weird Al.
Nirvana fans thought they were, I think.
But then I'd say, like,
grunge people.
Yeah, I'd say, like, Kurt Cobain signed off on it. He loved it. He wrote in his journal, like, Weird Al is a modern rock genius. Like, Kurt was, like, all in on the parody. And I had to explain that to quite a few fans that, like, you know, if Kurt's fine with it, you probably should cool off a little bit, too.
Now, you're still out there touring. I know you got a tour coming up. You're going to Europe soon, I think,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
Is what we heard. And you had a great tour end of last year. One of the most amazing things about you and your career and this, you know, and your material is it's kind of timeless. It always works. You have this ability to regenerate your audience over and over. Every year, there's a new group of young people who discover Weird Al and I think end up probably buying records and now listening on streaming and going to their shows, maybe with their parents who are fans. So the live shows are really like a big part of what you do. And I don't think you get enough attention from people in the media about what a great thing a Weird Al show is. Can you talk about your approach to live performance and what that means to you?
It's live performance is very special for me. It's my favorite part of what I do. I love getting that kind of positive reinforcement from the fans. And when I started out in the early 80s, it was a much younger crowd. I think my hardest core fans were probably 12-year-old boys, but those boys grew up. And now, like you said, they're bringing their kids and sometimes their grandkids to the show. It's a multi-generational experience. When I look out into the crowd, it's every age group imaginable, and they're all enjoying the show, maybe on a different level, but they're all having a great time. This tour that I just came off of was the Vanity Tour, which meant that it was the No Frills Tour. It was just like us sitting on stools and playing deep cuts from the album. So it's kind of geared more for the hardcore fans. But the usual show is a multimedia extravaganza. We get the costume changes and the film clips and the props. And it's a real show. You know, it's one of those kind of things that the whole family can enjoy. You know, it's something that never gets old, at least for me.
I remember seeing you in New York outdoors at the Dr. Pepper Festival on the pier with the Monkees.
Oh, yes, yes.
Right, when they had reformed and had come to some fame also through MTV, and it was bedlam, as I remember.
Yeah, that was a while. That was in 1987, and yeah.
Yeah, that was like, a while back. Yeah, that goes all the way back, Al.
I had one bus, and the Monkees had like seven buses. I remember that was a little bit of a blow to my ego at the time, because we'd show up in a city, and I'd get off the bus, and all these girls would run up to me and go, "Al, Al, Al. Al, where's Davey staying?"
were you headlining? Were they headlining? Was it a co-headlining?
Oh, no, they're headlining. Because I was coming off of a failed album. My fourth album, Polka Party, didn't do that well. And the Monkees were hot from the MTV syndicated run. So that, you know, everybody was
There's no shame in opening for the Monkees, Al. I think Jimi Hendrix wants
to. Oh, no. Yeah, I'm in good company there. No, I loved opening for the Monkees. It was a good double bill, because I was at a point where I felt like I couldn't really headline. Certainly not in a place that I was playing with the Monkees. So it just felt like a good call at the time. And I love those guys. That was great.
I'm going to say it now, Al, and I've said it before. Both you and the Monkees deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Why, thank you. Thank you.
There's no question in my mind. And
I would vote for both of us.
We got to go work with those people, Al. It's now run mostly by a lot of ex-MTVers.
Okay.
So Doug has influence. We've
got to remind them how great and important you are.
Thank you.
And influential.
So I want to ask you a little bit about Weird, the movie that, as Doug said earlier, we both really, really loved. And it was the perfect way to tell your story completely in your sensibility. When did you first start thinking about doing this project?
Well, the movie is based off of a Funny or Die video, which Eric pitched to me in 2010. He'd basically just seen the Notorious Biggie Smalls biopic, which also kind of played fast and loose with the facts. And, you know, all biopics you have to take with a grain of salt, because they always dramatize and make some things up. But it struck Eric that, you know, they just kind of like really didn't hold to the truth that much. So, and he thought, who could I do a biopic of that's had very little drama in their life and is in fact still alive? And he thought, oh, Weird Al, that'd be great. So he pitched me. He said, hey, what would you think about like doing this Funny or Die video? And I thought, oh, that's a great idea. When we kind of brainstormed and came up with some ideas, so we did the video for Funny or Die, and it went viral. It did very well online. And I played it in my live shows. It was one of the things I would do on the big screen while I'm doing costume changes. And this went on for years. And people would come up to me after the show and say, oh, when's the movie coming out? And I say, no, it's a bit. It's a gag. It's just a fake trailer. But it happened so much. And, you know, in 2009, after Bohemian Rhapsody came out, which, you know, got a lot of critical acclaim. And again, a lot of things, they kind of like messed with the chronology and some facts. Yeah. And I thought, oh, man, what?
A lot of things in that movie made me upset.
Yeah. Yeah. and biopics were coming back. And I thought, we have to actually do this movie. You know, we have to do the movie, but make it go way, way, way off the rails. You know, basically do a parody of a biopic.
There's a whole storyline in Weird about your marriage to Madonna, and it's very like exaggerated. And Evan Rachel Wood does such a great job of portraying Madonna. I thought she was excellent. What is your actual relationship with Madonna, if any? Like, what is your?
There really is none. The only time I even actually met Madonna was after her show at the Universal Amphitheater in 1985, and I went backstage and I got to meet the Beastie Boys. When they were just boys, they were opening for Madonna. And Madonna was getting presented with a gold record, I think, for something or other. And anyways, I just went up to her and I just introduced myself. And I think Like a Surgeon had come out at that point. And we talked for like 45 seconds maybe. And that's the extent of our relationship. Although I should point out, and this is sounds like urban legend, but it's actually true. One of the reasons I actually did Like a Surgeon is because Madonna was talking to a friend of hers in New York City one day and just wondered aloud, yeah, I wonder when Weird Al's going to do Like a Surgeon. And her friend knew my manager, Jay Levy, and Weird got back to me. And I thought, oh, that, yeah, sure, not a bad idea.
So there's a link.
She had a writing credit on that one?
No. in fact, she didn't even have a writing credit on Like a Virgin. So we didn't have to get her permission when we did Like a Surgeon. So I think after Like a Surgeon came out, she made a point of giving herself a writing credit on everything she released just so she'd be able to control it.
Well, I'm curious too. You know, obviously Weird is a very heightened and funny take on your own life. But is it strange at all to be revisiting even like little nuggets of truth again as a grown man? Like, I would think that would be kind of an emotional experience potentially.
It is. I mean, yeah, like you said, yeah, I mean, we're taking a lot of liberties, but there are a few nuggets of truth in there. In fact, the very first thing we shot was me and my roommates slash band in our old apartment. You know, we're kind of conflating a lot of things. I never actually lived with my band, but just seeing Daniel Radcliffe like staring at a package of bologna and having that epiphany, and it was just an odd thing for me to watch, because it was, you know, just moments from my life being recreated by an A-list actor. It was just pretty incredible for me.
So, movies, music, TV, film, videos, live performances, and now you've got a graphic novel coming.
Yeah, it's I don't know if it's officially out. It's I don't think it's officially out for another week or so, but it's kind of leaked out to comic book stores. Yeah, it's a cool little thing. It's Z2 Comics put out the Illustrated Al, which is basically a couple dozen of my favorite song lyrics, all interpreted graphically by some of my favorite cartoonists and illustrators.
Very cool.
Were you a comic fan growing up?
Yeah,
I mean, heard you talk about Mad Magazine a little bit.
Yeah, mostly Mad. I was absolutely obsessed with Mad, and in fact, there are some Mad artists included on that. I think Sam Viviano, who was Mad's art director for many years, did a nice caricature of Emo Phillips, who wrote the foreword to the book. It was really a kick for me to work with some people that had worked on some of my previous music videos, like Bill Plimpton and Aaron Augenblick, and a few others. It was just a fun project. It's a nice little thing to have on the shelf.
So coming to comic book stores soon.
I think it's in comic book stores now, but you can order it off of Amazon, like, I think next week starting.
Yeah, by the time this comes out, it'll be.
For our listeners, by the time you hear this, it will be available.
Okay.
So I'm sure you've been asked this many, many times, and I know it's a hard question for artists to answer about their own impact, but given the just, as we were talking about earlier, just how long and how enduring your work has been, what do you think is the appeal that makes it, you know, have this, you know, resonance with people who grew up watching you and listening to you like I did, and then people who are much younger?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to, you know, Dissect the Frog. But I think nowadays a lot of the appeal is nostalgia because of the people that grew up with me, some of the early songs, even though they're quite dated, there's a nostalgic appeal for a lot of people. But at the time, and certainly currently, there's also the thing of irreverence. Like, people, you know, I'm making fun of something. I'm taking something that other people take seriously and just, you know, kind of letting some air out of the bubble, you know. So, and I think people react to that, and people are always appreciative when people get, other people get taken down a peg, especially if it's not in an unkind way. I try not to, you know, be mean-spirited in any of my parodies. It's all done in good fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, if I may be so bold as to tell you why you're important.
Please.
Go on.
I mean, I think a lot of it, too, is just that, as we've been talking about, what you were doing was so unusual and so idiosyncratic. And, you know, when you're a kid, you don't want to be any of those things because you're really trying to conform. But I think so many people respect and feel a kinship with somebody who just is themselves and is so having so much fun doing it. And that's what I always have liked about you and your work.
Thank you. You know, that's sort of the subtext of the movie.
Yeah.
Daniel Radcliffe makes a speech at the end, but it's also the subtext of my life. And, you know, there are times in my life when I thought, oh, gosh, should I have called myself Weird Al? I've been Weird Al my whole life. Like, why did I do that to myself? But then I hear from people that were empowered by that, people that were, you know, outcasts or, you know, freaks or, you know, weirdos, people that didn't fit in society. And they'd look at me and go, oh, well, here's a guy that was different and was kind of following, you know, the beat of his own drummer. And he came out okay. So, you know, maybe it's okay for me to let my freak flag fly.
All right, Al. So our general final question, which will be our next to last question, maybe, is, do you have a favorite all-time basic cable show?
I'd have to give props to The State. And and Human Giant, I love the comedy in that show. So a lot of the sketch comedy stuff that MTV did, I'd have to put that right at the top of the list.
Well, Weird Al Yankovic, it has been our supreme pleasure to have you here today. Like I said, this is a interview we've been looking forward to almost from the day we decided we were going to embark on this series of conversations about the old cable world. So we're glad you made time for us today.
Well, that's nice to hear. And Doug, it's so good to see you. It's been a while, and you're
been an
old friend, and I appreciate everything you've done for me in your life. So thank you so much.
It was so great to talk to Weird Al Yankovic. I've never talked to him before. I know, obviously, you know him pretty well, Doug, but...
A little bit for a long time.
Yeah. And as we talked about, it's just so remarkable that he's still going with his career, still part of the cultural conversation, you know, 40 years or maybe even more than 40 years into what he's been doing. And I just remember growing up, like, in the era that he was describing, the Dr. Demento era. And even outside of Dr. Demento, there were, like, novelty songs that would get popular, you know, on mainstream radio. It was like a whole genre. And aside from Weird Al, I don't think that really exists anymore. I mean, the only equivalent I can come up with is when somebody does like a funny parody on like YouTube or TikTok that maybe blows up for a couple of days, but that's not really the same thing.
No, and he really transcended the whole thing somehow.
Yeah.
You know, just other than just being a novelty. That's why I was pressing him. I'm like, what was the record company thinking and saying to you? And how did they see you? I have to imagine they saw him as this guy who might have three or four or five of those things. And then thanks very much.
Right.
But he transcended the whole thing. And you know, like, he's a good director. He's a really good writer. He's really funny. He can act a little bit. He's a great performer. I mean, he's very singular. He's very distinct. He's very specific, but he's very funny, and he's still here.
And I also think the sense of humor that he has and that so much of his work has is not the kind of like very wry, know-it-all sort of satire that we see and that I, you know, like very much. But there's a certain just, let's just be silly and just be joyful about being silly. I mean, that's how I felt when I was watching Weird. It was just so much fun. And like he said, it's not, none of it's mean-spirited, really. It's just silly in the best possible way.
No, but it's not soft either.
No.
It's very clever.
Right.
And it kind of works and it holds up too. I mean, you know, that, like, you know, I've been revisiting the songs before doing this interview today, and he said, you know, they're outdated. I don't think so. I think they hold up great. I love hearing them. I feel the same way hearing them as I do hearing other songs from that era. They bring me back.
Right.
Right. It was a song of its time.
I mean, if for some reason they feel outdated, it's only because the songs are kind of old. Like their source material
right.
is old,
right.
but like what right. he's doing with it doesn't feel outdated to me at all.
Yeah. I mean, I think really underrated, you know, sort of artist in a lot of different ways. And yeah, he probably should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he should probably have a, you know, get some more accolades than maybe he has received. And he's done it all his way. So, you know, good for him. I don't think he ever stopped being Weird Al. You know, the Weird Al sort of brand certainly has evolved, but I think it's also, you know, very true to the core that was there in the early 80s.
For sure. So, I mean, I think we have an assignment. Now that my beloved Duran Duran is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it is our job now to get Weird Al in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I was kind of surprised you didn't ask. Has he ever done a Duran Duran parody?
Not that I can think of, no.
I was a little surprised you didn't ask him that, Jen, I have to
say. Oh, really? Oh, I'm sorry. Can I get him back on the line?
maybe we'll dial him back up. Hungry Like the...
I mean, Hungry's right there. That's a food parody. He's got to be able to do something with that.
There's got to be something there. All right. Well, we hope you enjoyed our time with Weird Al, and we look forward to having you next time on Basic.
Basic is a Pantheon Media production in partnership with SiriusXM.
Hosted by Jen Chaney
and Doug Herzog.
Produced by Christian Swain and Peter Ferrioli.
Lindley Ehrlich is our assistant producer.
Sound design and music by Jerry Danielson.
Mixed and mastered by Brian Slusher.
Recorded and edited by Zach Spisner.
You can find Basic on Apple Podcasts, the SiriusXM app, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. If you like the show, please rate, review, and share so other people can find us.
Don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.